Right.
Awesome.
Okay, brethren, our Bible study has commenced again, and we're moving on now in the Gospel of Matthew, of course. So we take our Bibles and open to where we got to last week, which was Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24, excuse me, and you remember we just got to the middle portion of that chapter dealing with, I think ultimately, the abomination of desolation. Not necessarily the most clear part of the prophecies here. And as we said last week, when we're looking at prophecy, it can get very speculative. We see through a glass darkly at this time. And no doubt, as we get right into prophetic events, it will become more clear to us. But what we can certainly do at this stage is we can be familiar with the words of prophecy. We can be familiar with the descriptions, the signs that we see, the details. Exactly what they mean in reality, in practice, when they are fulfilled, perhaps we can't always be too dogmatic. There are plenty of ideas bouncing around the whole church world, whether it's the evangelical Protestant church world, whether it's the splits and splinters of the Church of God. There are plenty of views and speculations about what this prophecy means or that prophecy. So I don't think we want to get necessarily too dogmatic, but we can certainly, like I say, be familiar with the actual topics and the words and so on. Last week we concluded roundabout, I think, verse 22, but let's just read verses 21 and 22 again. Quite a dramatic pronouncement from Jesus. He's talking of the end time, and he says, verse 21 of Matthew 24, "For then, at this future time, there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved or be saved alive. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened." And I think, as we said last time, this really is a dramatic announcement. I first heard this verse way back when I was, I think, 15 years old. Mr. Garnet and Armstrong, at that time, broadcasting on the World Tomorrow over the so-called ship radios or pirate radio stations in Great Britain. And I had never seen this verse ever in my relatively short life. And the idea that what? A great tribulation unequaled in all man's history? So you mean even the Second World War and the death and sort of death camps of 6 million Jews and Gypsies and sundry others? Wow, it's going to be worse than that. And indeed, verse 22, unless the days were cut short, you know, by God's intervention, man would actually blast himself, annihilate himself off the face of the earth with no flesh saved alive. To me, that was just like, not unbelievable, because I can believe what I can see in Scripture, but it was like unbelievable. How could that happen? And I heard nothing about that when I went to Mass on Sundays. The priest would stand up and go through his Latin verses, and there'd be incense and candles and various incantations and so on, and we'd stand up and kneel down and stand up and kneel down and beat our breasts and all the rest of it. And somehow that seemed totally irrelevant when here was Scripture plainly saying that at the end time things would get so bad, so completely destructive, that if God didn't take a hand and intervene, no flesh, no human life would survive. Now that's a crisis at the close of the age. And of course, I guess we're familiar with these verses, but that could make us at times sort of so familiar, so overly familiar, that they lose their impact. But these verses are, you know, are telling of a dreadful time yet to come, when, quite honestly, it would be, I think, in many people's eyes, a great opportunity to be taken to a place of refuge or safety, because the world conditions will get so bad. It'll be a time of tribulation, of trial, of trouble, unheard of, unequaled in all man's history. And there have been some pretty bad times, let's face it, but this is the worst time ever. The crisis at the close of the age, and Jesus said that time is coming. And when will it come? Well, it will come at the time when you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place. And last week we said, well, you know, there are different views of that. Mr. Ted Armstrong, right up to, I believe, the day of his death, considered that there would be a Jewish temple constructed in Jerusalem, and that possibly the Pope and or maybe some statue would be placed in there, and that would be the abomination of desolation. The counter-argument to that is that if the Jews were to build a building called a temple, it wouldn't be necessarily in God's eyes a holy place, because God has not commissioned another Jewish temple. And since the Jews would be doing it off their own bat, well, that's just a building. They may be called a temple, but it's not a holy place. Mr. Armstrong Sr., Mr. Herbert Armstrong, said that the abomination of desolation would be armies surrounding Jerusalem, preparatory to going in and leveling the city and killing and bringing brutality and cruelty to the occupants thereof. And other views of latter years are that the temple, the holy place, is the church of God. That's today's temple being built unto the Lord. You and I are part and parcel of that temple, but there is an abomination in it, something detestable and loathsome, which arguably is the Laodiceans, and Mr. Fleury reckons that's most of us. Okay, but like we said last week, you pay your money, you take your chance. Right, moving on to verse 23, still talking of these end times, and remember, you know, Jesus is sitting with his disciples on the Mount of Olives, hence it's called the Olivet prophecy. It runs all the way through Matthew 24, right to the end of Matthew 25. It's one long, relatively long discussion that Jesus has. It doesn't stop at the end of Matthew 24. But in verse 23 here it says, then, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders, so as to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you or warned you beforehand. Therefore, if they say to you, look, he is in the desert, do not go out looking for him. Or look, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe it. So at this end time, world troubles will be obviously frightening, terrifying, and people are going to produce all manner of experts and messiahs who are going to say, you know, I've got the answers. But they won't be the real messiah. And Jesus is not coming back in some sort of secretive fashion. If they say, well, we know Jesus is out in the desert place somewhere, like say Petra or somewhere, well, don't believe him. If he's in some inner secret place, don't believe them. There'll be plenty of people at this time showing, it says here, great signs and wonders, quite impressive to the average person in the audience, but they will not be the real Christ. Because, carrying on, verse 27, for as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. It'll be quite evident, quite obvious. It will not be something surreptitious and in secret. For wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, which is right of the Great Tribulation, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And Mr. Armstrong did spend a bit of time really on this verse, because I think he saw it as one of the areas that we differ so strongly from much of the Protestant world. To the average Protestant, I believe at least, the tribulation, day of the Lord, are all sort of lumped together as one period. Mr. Armstrong would say, no, that's a complete misunderstanding. There is a time element here. You have the Great Tribulation, and then verse 29 says, after the tribulation, you get these heavenly signs. Okay, so if the Great Tribulation, a time unparalleled in man's history, a time that is so horrific that God has to intervene and stop man from destroying himself. But then verse 29, immediately after the tribulation, then you get these heavenly signs. The sun turns dark, the moon does not give its light, the stars fall from heaven, so I guess meteor storms and so on, the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then after that, said Mr. Armstrong, then comes, separately, the day of the Lord. So you've got tribulation, heavenly signs, day of the Lord. Most Protestants, I believe, tend to just throw them all together in one big lump, and they mix the two up. And if you do that, you do miss a great deal of what prophecy is saying. If we turn back to Joel or Joel chapter 1, and I'll take a bit of time on this because Mr. Armstrong always did, so, and I have come across this alternate view in the Persian world a few times. They don't seem like they mix up Israel, don't they? Most of the world's churches, when they're talking of prophecy, they seem to see Israel, wherever mentioned, as purely being the Jewish nation. So when it says that certain things happen to Israel, they apply that purely to the small country today in the Middle East. And yet you and I know that most prophecies referring to Israel are talking about Britain and America. So in that area alone, they misunderstand. The other area is that they tend to lose the distinction between the tribulation, which is Satan's wrath primarily on Israel, but Satan's fairly indiscriminate, so others get roped into that as well. And then you have the heavenly signs, and then you have the day of the Lord, which is God's intervention to punish mankind. And there's two quite distinct periods there. Joel chapter 1, starting verse 15. Alas for the day of the Lord, I'll use that expression, well, in David Eternal, the day of the Lord is at hand, it shall come as destruction from the Almighty. So this particular destruction is coming from God Almighty, and it's called the day of the Lord, the day of Jehovah, the day of the Eternal. Dropping down to chapter 2, starting verse 1. Blow the trumpet in Zion and sound an alarm in my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the Lord is coming, for it is at hand, a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness. The day of the Lord is covered a great deal in this book of Joel. Verse 11, the latter part of verse 11 of chapter 2, for the day of the Lord is great and very terrible. Who can endure it? Pretty good question. When God sets his hand to sort out the world, he'll do it, you know, thoroughly. And nobody's going to stand against God successfully. It says here again, the day of the Lord is great and very terrible. Who can endure it? But is it the same thing as the tribulation? Well, no. Chapter 2, verse 31, this is the verse I wanted to get to. Verse 31, the sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood. That's what we read of in Matthew 24. After the tribulation, the sun shall be darkened, the moon shall lose its light, and so on. Here it says, verse 31, the sun shall be turned into darkness, the moon into blood, before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. So the heavenly signs come in between. Remember Matthew 24, it says, after the tribulation of those days, you get the heavenly signs. Joel says here that you get the heavenly signs before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. There's a progression. Great tribulation lasts, we believe, something like about 2.5 years. The beast power and Satan and so on, stomping on Britain and America for about 2.5 years. Great tribulation, then the heavenly signs, and then about 1 year or so, the day of the Lord, as God intervenes and cuts short and deals with mankind his way. So the heavenly signs, they come right in the middle. If we also turn to Revelation chapter 6, we can see the same timing revealed. Revelation chapter 6. Revelation chapter 6 is the first six seals that Jesus was able to open. And we'll skip out seals 1, 2, 3, 4, and even 5. Seal number 5 is the martyrdom of the saints during the Great Tribulation. So some saints are going to be killed. Don't know if you want to be one of them or escape that, but many of the saints will be killed in the Great Martyrdom. There is seal number 5 that takes place during the tribulation. But then picking up the story now with seal number 6, and that's verse 12, Revelation chapter 6, verse 12. I looked when he, Jesus, opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became like blood, sort of dark red in color, and the stars of heaven fell to the earth as a fig tree drops its late figs when it is shaken by a mighty wind. So recognize that, hopefully. These are the heavenly signs, which Jesus said in Matthew 24, come after the tribulation. And that seems to fit in here, because seal number 5, the martyrdom during the tribulation. Then you get these heavenly signs. The sun becomes black. The moon becomes as a deep red color, loses its light. The stars or meteors, whatever, come tumbling to the earth. Verse 14, then the sky receded as a scroll when it is rolled up. Every mountain and island were moved out of its place. The kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, every slave, every free man, hid themselves in the caves and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us, and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand? This is the great day of God's wrath. The day of the Lord has now come. And that's why these guys and gals are all hiding, because they've been warned, and they know what's now imminent. But notice that it's the tribulation, then the heavenly signs, and then the great day of the Lord, his wrath, has come. Okay, back to Matthew 24. Well, I think we know that anyway, but it's one of those issues that, you know, I occasionally pick up a Protestant prophecy book. I get very frustrated very quickly, usually, particularly over the fact that all prophecies of Israel turn out to be applicable only to the little tiny country of the Jews today, and I get quite annoyed when I read that. And then, of course, you discover that they don't know the tribulation from the day of the Lord, and yet, you know, they are separate periods, divided by the heavenly signs. Okay, so let's read that again in Matthew 24:29, and then move on. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, afterwards, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from heaven, the powers of the heavens will be shaken, and then, of course, the day of the Lord comes. That should be sort of fairly plain. Then, verse 30, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. And that sort of concludes that portion, in a sense, of Jesus' rather hurried look at the future. Remember, he'd been asked a question, Jesus, when will all these things happen? What will be the sign of your return? Explain to us. And Jesus has taken them right up there to his return. The angels going out and bringing the saints together. But then Jesus sort of changes tack slightly, because having given a brief resume of the forthcoming 2,000 years, and particularly the events at the end time, Jesus now seems to sort of turn his attention to warning his disciples, of which you and I are his disciples. And so the next portion of Matthew 24 and all of Matthew 25 seems to me, at least, to be largely Jesus giving plenty of warning about our need to be vigilant. There's potentially two themes through the rest of 24 and 25, or maybe it's just one theme. The two themes, I'll make it easier that way, are be ready, be ready, be ready, be ready, be ready, because, theme two if you like, there is a separation coming. And really, I guess it's one theme. It's just that, you know, those who are ready will be separated from those who are left behind because they weren't ready. So you could call it two themes if you want, be ready and a separation, but really, those who are ready are the ones who are separate from those who are not ready. So when we read the next sort of parables and illustrations through Matthew 24 and all the way through 25, all of them have all got the same basic theme. Be ready, because there's a separation. And depending on whether you're ready or not, you'll be in one or the other. So let's continue with that sort of backdrop. Verse 32. And like I say, Jesus is now starting to provide, if you like, a warning, trying to get his disciples, and that must include you and me today, because we're living in these end time days. We need to be vigilant, alert, because it certainly applies to us. Verse 32, "Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near." And most of us know that. In the winter time, lots of the bushes and trees are very sort of dried up and rough and tough. But come springtime, of course, they get nice and supple and start to push out little leaves and nice light green colour. And you think, oh, great. Spring's arrived, and as a fig tree puts forth its leaves, you think, yeah, it's nearly summer. And how do you know that? Well, because you can tell. You look at the sign. The signs, you can see the tree is at that stage where it's showing you clearly that summer is just around the corner. Verse 33, "So you also, when you see all these things that he's talked about, know that it is near at their very doors." And therefore what? Well, therefore be ready. When you see the signs of the times, be ready, because it's close, it's near, it's almost upon you, it's nigh. And what would you and I, what should we be doing? If we know that the end is nigh, as the old placards used to say, you know, beware, behold, the end is nigh. If the end is nigh, we should not be loafing about, idle, and distracted, immersed in doing our own thing, should we? If we know that the end is nigh, is near, if the signs of the times are plain before your nose, then we should be prepared. Be ready, and that's precisely what Jesus is on about in the next couple of pages of the Bible. "Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things are fulfilled." So when they're all visible, it will happen. It will come to pass. "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away." And then here comes a warning of, you know, former times. "But of that day and hour no one knows, no, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only." So certainly in way back then, even Jesus didn't know. I imagine he knows now, because 2,000 years has passed, and things that he didn't need to know when he was ministering on the earth, I'm sure he's now perfectly aware of that. But in those days, even Jesus didn't know the day and the hour. And if you don't know exactly, then of course you have to be careful, wouldn't you, not to be thinking, well, I've got a good idea, it might be on such and such a date, I will start preparing a month before then. Well, you don't know. Nobody knows for sure, even today. Verse 37, "But as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know or did not understand until the flood came and took them all away, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be." So that's an illustration, says Jesus. Way back then, before the flood, these people just carried on living quite happily. They ate, they drank, they partied, they got married, right up until the day that Noah went into the ark. And you think, well, will it be that way at the end? Even among God's people? Is that possible? Yeah. Absolutely. That's what Jesus is saying to his disciples. It will be that way. If you think back to the days of Noah, you know, Noah was a preacher of righteousness. Noah warned the people for decades of a coming flood, of a coming destruction. They were warned. They ignored him. They had, if you like, you know, a sign, didn't they? There's an ark being built, a big ark. Not your average routine ark, but a great big ark, a long one. You know, one-off sign that looked at Noah's ark, and probably people came from miles around to look at it and to scoff at it, mock at it, or maybe be impressed by it, who knows. But they had a sign, and obviously the ark took a long time to build, but at some point it must have been obvious that this guy's nearly finished this, you know. He's you know, been working at it for a long, long time now, and teams of labourers, but you know, I reckon he'll be finished in another week or two. So the ark was there, it took time, but there came a point where you could see that the ark was virtually finished. The work was almost complete. The warnings were still going out. Yet people ignored them. Until what? Until it was too late. That's Jesus' point. They left it too late. They kept on doing their own thing, living their own way, paying no regard to God's warnings, God's messages, the truths. And in goes Noah to the ark with his family, immediate family, and of course God slammed the door shut. And I would have imagined at that point that some people did stop and just start to get a bit anxious, but too late. It says, verse 39, they did not know, or I think one translation says, did not understand, until the flood came and, it says, swept them all away, in one translation. So also will the coming of the Son of Man be. Many will be destroyed, killed, because they were not ready. And that's Jesus' point. There will be a separation. Many will be destroyed. As in Noah's day, some will be saved. As in Noah's day, in a place of safety. And what's the difference? Well, some will be ready. Many won't. I guess the question that you've got to ask yourself is, will you be among the ready or the unready? Because there is a separation coming. That's Jesus' entire message here. Let's continue in verse 40. Then two men will be in the field. One will be taken and the other left. So you've got a separation. One is taken and one is left. I guess that's 50%, 50%, isn't it? 50% are taken and 50% are left. Two women, it says, will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken, the other left. 50% taken, 50% left. 50-50 split. Separation. And the overall theme here is those who are ready will be taken, and those who are not ready will be left. It's not 100% clear, but the Greek, I think, implies what the being taken and being left actually refers to. When it says that one will be taken, that's a Greek word. No surprise there, of course. Original Greek word is paralambano, a nice little word. P-A-R-A, para, lambano, L-A-M-B-A-N-O, para lambano. That's to be taken. And that means in the Greek, to receive near to oneself, to associate with oneself. So if you can imagine, Jesus, the Lord, taking people to himself, it would have that meaning, to receive to oneself. You'll find it, for example, in, I won't turn there, but back in Matthew chapter 1, you remember Joseph was a bit concerned to find out his betrothed young lady was pregnant. And the angel said, Joseph, don't worry, take Mary as your wife. It's the same word as here. Take Mary as your wife, take her to yourself, associate with her. Then later on, when Herod got a bit sort of violent, the angel said, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt. Same Greek word. So you can get the impression at least that the one who is taken into a close relationship, taken in association to probably to Jesus. So that's potentially that one who is taken to safety. Then it says the other is left behind, which is the name of course, a famous series of novels, the Left Behind series. And that's from the Greek word aphiemi, which is A-P-H. I-E-M-I, A-P-H-I-E-M-I, aphiemi. And that has the meaning of to leave behind, to dismiss, to neglect, to disregard, to yield up. It can also mean to forgive, strangely enough. But to yield up, to disregard, to neglect, to leave behind, to dismiss, to divorce. So the ones who are left behind are the ones who, it seems, who are dismissed, disregarded. If you turn to Matthew 23 for a moment, since we're very close there, Matthew 23 and verse 38, just one little short verse, Matthew 23:38. See, your house is left to you desolate. That's the same word, left, to leave behind, to dismiss, to neglect. Your house is left to you desolate. So I'm not going to be dogmatic, but it looks like the ones who are left are actually left behind to destruction, left desolate. Okay, verse 42, and Jesus summarizes, "Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming." So his primary point really is, be vigilant, be watchful, be ready, and like I say, that is the theme throughout the next couple of pages. Jesus uses different illustrations, different examples, different parables, but his point remains the same, be ready. Now why is he saying that? Why would Jesus say be ready, be alert? Well, because he knows the problem. He knows that at the end time, unfortunately, even though the signs of the times are there, even though people have been warned and warned and warned and warned and warned, unfortunately, Jesus knows that altogether too many will not be watching, will not be vigilant, will not be alert. Carrying on to verse 43, "But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready. For the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not expect him." There's obviously some strange things going to happen at the end. It's going to be rather confusing in terms of what precisely prophecies might mean. But it says here that Jesus is going to come back at an hour when you do not expect him. Therefore, says Jesus, be ready. Because obviously, if you're ready, you're ready. Whether Jesus comes in the morning, or at noontime, or the evening, or a day later, or a month later, if you're ready, you're ready. And that's what you and I must be, ready. I suppose the question would be that, you know, I know Jesus is not coming tomorrow. He's not like people who believe in the rapture. It can happen at any time. And I suppose in some strange way that might help some of them, because since they believe that the rapture could happen while you're sleeping in a bed tomorrow morning or driving off to the golf course this afternoon, some of them, hopefully, who are sincere and genuine, probably keep themselves continually ready. For some of God's people, since we've got everything figured out, that is going to be, you know, so many signs and wonders and 10 nations here and all the rest over there, we're thinking, yeah, well, when I see all these signs, then I'll start being serious about my calling. Somebody says apathetic, Laodicean, lukewarm, because we think we've got it sorted out. Well, maybe, maybe not. But the only safe approach is to be ready. And you should be ready today. And tomorrow. And yesterday as well. And so should I. So Jesus said, verse 44, be ready. Be ready. It's not that hard a message, is it? Be ready. Let's turn to Luke 21 for a moment. Luke 21, we can see as a parallel passage, because Luke 21 is also the Olivet prophecy portion. Luke 21, but Luke records it slightly differently. And we start in verse 29. Luke 21, beginning in verse 29. "And Jesus spoke to them a parable. Look at the fig tree and indeed all the trees." Because you can't say, well, we ain't got any fig trees where I live, so, you know, but you've got trees surely somewhere, or your, you know, hedge or shrub. When they're already budding, you see and know for yourselves that summer is now near. So you likewise, when you see these things happening, know that the kingdom of God is near. Assuredly I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all things are fulfilled. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly. It shouldn't really, because you and I should be aware, alert, and watchful. But says Jesus, take heed. And that's the warnings in red letters. And we can't just say, well, of course, that applies to those folk out there in, you know, in the PCG or, you know, the United or the Living or whatever. This applies to those who are the called. This applies to Christ's disciples. He says, take heed to yourselves, whoever you are, lest your heart be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. And a snare, of course, is unexpected to the animal, and it's sudden as well. You know, animals padding along the path to the waterhole, puts its foot down and bang, is caught, trapped suddenly, unexpectedly, didn't see it coming. Verse 36, watch therefore. The New American says, keep on the alert. Stay alert. Stay alive. Be awake. Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. And you know, what more can Jesus do than just repeat again and again and again, be ready, be watchful, be alert, be on guard. If you and I don't, if we ignore the watchman message, then, you know, can hardly blame God, can we? We're sitting there in a concentration camp or something. Right, moving back to Matthew 20, where are we, 24. Right, picking up in verse 45 now. And again, we can see here, I think, the reference to being ready and to a separation. Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Assuredly, I say to you, he will make him ruler over all his goods. So this seems to me we're talking about perhaps the leadership, or even a leader among God's people. And it says that the one that gets the commendation is the one that is busy doing the right thing whenever the master returns. Not sort of just keeping an eye and thinking, you know, if I'm being watched, I'll do good. This is a person that is busy doing what is right, who is faithful throughout. And you know, whether the master returns, you know, early or midday or late, the master finds this particular faithful servant, faithful minister perhaps, faithful leader of his church, doing what is right at all seasons. Okay, and it says he'll make him ruler over his household. That term ruler is not a very good translation perhaps, because some individuals among God's people have tried to sort of pretty much set themselves up as rulers and use the odd mistranslation to support that, but the Greek more implies to set over or to preside over or to place over, and in fact I think some of the other translations pretty much say that, that you'll be placed over. So this faithful servant who is busy doing what he's called to do and commissioned to do, that faithful servant is placed over the master's goods. But then there's another servant, verse 48, but if that evil servant says in his heart, not necessarily openly, but in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, it's not going to happen, not for ages yet, and begins to beat his fellow servants. So that suggests, if you like, a leader, a leading minister perhaps, who is very harsh on his fellow ministers perhaps, and begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunkards. Well, you know, spiritually the world is drunk. The world's doctrines are like drunk's vomit, it says way back in Isaiah. So here's perhaps a leader among God's people who sees no early return of the Messiah, who starts to badly treat fellow ministers and starts to hobnob and starts to associate with the world. I wonder if we can recognize that sort of history. Then verse 50, the master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him, at an hour that he is not aware of, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So you can see a separation there, you know, two types of servant. A wise servant who's doing the right thing and is always prepared, and of course an evil servant that slopes off, does his own thing because he assumes the master is a long way off, so he's not ready, not prepared. Now some people have taken that, those verses, and applied them to Herbert Armstrong as the faithful and wise servant, and the Tkachas as the other ones, the evil servants that beat up fellow ministers, force them to teach false doctrine, and of course associate with the spiritual drunkenness of this world. Can't say that I usually argue with that. Interesting interpretation. Right, Matthew 25. And this is still Jesus, still talking to his disciples. It's the same discussion. And he's still, as far as I'm concerned at least, still talking about separation from those who are ready, with the clear instruction, be ready, be ready, be ready. Because we now get to the 10 virgins, of which several, well, 50%, were not ready. Verse 1. Then the kingdom of heaven shall be likened to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Now five of them were wise and five were foolish. So 50% were okay, wise, prudent, but a good half of them were pretty stupid. Foolish is probably in some ways a translation that's a bit too weak or too light, because you almost get the impression it's like five were wise and five just a little bit careless. Well, there's a bit more than that, I think, to the foolish virgins, because the term fool, as used by Jesus, was quite a strong term of condemnation. If you turn back to Matthew chapter 5 and read verse 22. Matthew chapter 5, verse 22, which we read some weeks ago now. You'll see Jesus explaining the truth. He says, well, in olden days, people said various things, and you're often paying heed to those. But I say unto you, you know, this is the word of God. This is, I am Jehovah God. I say, this is the end of the story. No further arguments. I say to you, verse 22, I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. Whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. And that's the same word as later in Matthew 25. The foolish virgins, you fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. So fool is a strong condemnation. If you use that terminology, says Jesus, against somebody, wow, you know, you're really in serious trouble, because that's an awful thing to say about somebody. To say you fool, the Greek word is moros, M-O-R-O-S, from which we get our word moron. And, you know, whoever says you moron, you fool, you moros, shall be in danger of hellfire. So I think we can gather from that verse alone that Jesus uses the term fool or foolish as being a term of great condemnation. A serious judgment to assess somebody as a fool is very, very heavy, very serious. Not just somebody a bit careless. You fool, you'll be in danger of hellfire. If we turn to Matthew chapter 7, we can see Jesus using the same term again. Matthew chapter 7, and read verses 24 through 27, one of my favorite little parables or stories, because there's so much just plain simple truth in it. And therefore, says Jesus, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, that's the big challenge, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. So we're going to see a wise and a foolish person here. And the rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. That's a wise person that does Jesus' sayings. Verse 26, now everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand, the rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew, beat on that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. Well, the foolish man is the same word again, moros. So the person that hears Jesus' sayings, that comes along to church, if I use that expression, that reads magazines and booklets and listens to cassettes, the person that hears the sayings of Jesus and does not do them is a fool. Okay, back to Matthew 25. So when we read here about five foolish virgins, we're talking about foolish here is quite a serious description. It's not just five or a little bit sort of careless and a bit slipshod around the side. These people were in serious trouble, big trouble, because they were, by the sound of it, people that heard, perhaps attended, perhaps went to the feasts, right? But didn't do. In fact, other parables talk about the wheat and the tares who grow side by side, don't they? And for a while they even look the same. And they're allowed to grow side by side, side by side, side by side, up until harvest time. Then, of course, the tares discover that they're headed somewhere different from the wheat. Seems to be a similar story here. But remember, the key thing Jesus is talking about is a separation based upon those who are ready. And five were wise, verse 2, five were foolish. Those who are foolish, stupid, morons, took their lamps and took no oil with them. Well, why would you take a lamp with no oil? What good's that? I mean, that is stupid, isn't it? They go off into the dark somewhere in a big cave, and you're going to go hunting for a treasure, and you take a torch along and no battery. What fat lot of use that is? Into the cave you go, switch it on in darkness. In this case, the foolish took their lamps, but no oil. But the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps. While the bridegroom was delayed, at least in their perception, they all slumbered and slept. And at midnight, a cry was heard, "Behold, the bridegroom is coming, go out to meet him." Then all the virgins arose and trimmed their lamps, or made their lamps ready, prepared them, switched them on. And guess what happened? Well, of course, the wise, their lamps sprang into action, and the light was there, and ready to go. But the foolish, hang on a second, it's not working. My lamp's not lighting. I'm sort of striking up all the appropriate flames and all the rest of it, but nothing's lighting up. And the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." Or some translations say our lamps are gone out. In fact, they're not even lighting. It isn't that they've been running for a while and now just finally going out. There's no oil with them. They had no oil. So the best they're going to get was perhaps the wick might have smouldered for a few moments, but no light. There's nothing there. The old bishop's translation, which is predates, the King James says, our lamps are gone out. They didn't even start. But the wise answered, saying, No, lest there should not be enough for us and you. We can't do that. We need what we've got. But go, rather, to those who sell and buy for yourselves. Go off, try and get some. But we're already ready. And verse 10, while they went to buy, as they were going to buy, the bridegroom came. And those who were ready, went in with him to the wedding, and the door was shut. See, there's a time element here, isn't there? You can't just wait forever and ever and ever and just think, I'll get around to one of these days, and when I see those 10 nations in Europe uniting, and I see the Pope moving his headquarters to Jerusalem, and when I see, etc., etc., then, at that point, I'll blow the dust off my Bible and start studying, and I'll fast, once or twice more. Well, great idea, but it won't work. There's a time element, and things won't necessarily happen quite as we foresee. But those who are ready, of course, are ready. And when the cry comes, they are ready. And they go into this particular place. Some people think this is referring to the place of safety, rather than actually the final wedding, but we'll see. Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But he answered and said, "Assuredly, I say to you, I don't know you, don't recognize you." And Jesus sums up, if you like, the basic core meaning. You could interpret, lamps and vessels and oil and so on and so forth. And I think most of us see the lamps as picturing God's word, because it pretty much says so over in Psalms, that thy word is a lamp unto my feet, my path. So we generally see the lamps as picturing God's law, God's word. The oil, by and large, I think most of us tend to take as being God's Holy Spirit, and so on. But the core, meaning Jesus explains verse 13, "Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming. Watch, because there's going to come a separation." And this particular separation shows 50% going in to this particular place, and 50% not making it, a separation. And those who are ready are the ones who go in, and those who are the unready are the ones who remain out. So again, the theme continues. And even the next parable, which you can interpret not different ways, but you've got several, angles to it. But again, you can see here a separation of sorts. Verse 14, "For the kingdom of heaven is like a man traveling to a far country who called his own servants and delivered his goods to them. And to one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his own ability, and immediately he went on a journey." So these talents are actually a valuable amount of silver. According to my margin here, it says that five talents is equal to $1.92 million. Not quite sure where that would have come from, but it sounds like a significant sum of money. And so one person gets five of these valuable investments, one gets two, somebody else gets one, each according to his ability, which sort of implies that God does give us, you know, certain opportunities, certain investments in us, applicable to our, you know, basic temperament, our basic talents, our basic abilities. And then, I think one translation says, at once he who had received the five talents went and traded with them and made another five talents. This guy's, or gal, whichever, don't want to be sexist here, this man or woman, races off into action. Right, got five talents. Whoa, that's a lot. Let me see what I can do with these. And this person is enthusiastic, up for it. Off they go, start trading, start being busy, start occupying, and they have a 100% increase. You know, five becomes ten. Likewise, he had received two, gained two more also. So again, industrious, busy, gets to work. But he received one, went and dug in the ground and hid his Lord's money. Not so good. After a long time, the Lord of those servants came and settled accounts with them. Let's say a long time, and I suppose, you know, the apostles all thought Jesus would come back in their lifetime, but I guess with the odd hint here and there that he might be longer than that, lads, because, you know, this parable, Jesus obviously referring to himself, he said, after a long time, the Lord of those servants came and settled accounts with them. So he received five talents, came and brought five other talents, saying, Lord, you delivered to me five talents. Look, I've gained five more talents besides them. His Lord said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. You were faithful over a few things. I'll make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord. So the Lord's very happy. This guy's taken five talents and he's doubled them. Well done, pretty good. You're faithful. I like that. I appreciate that. Enter into the joy of your Lord. I'm going to make you ruler over many things. You've got a big reward coming your way. Verse 22, he also received two talents, came and said, Lord, you delivered to me two talents. Look, I have gained two more talents besides them. His Lord said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a few things. I'll make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord. So separation taking place, because these two guys who've been industrious, been busy, been prepared, let's say been ready, always, have done well, and they go a particular direction, entering into the joy of their Lord. Now the other guy, of course, he's going to end up somewhere else, isn't he? Then he received the one talent, came and said, Lord, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed, which is pretty insulting, you think about it. And I was afraid and went and hid your talent in the ground. Look, there, you have what is yours. But his Lord answered and said to him, you wicked and lazy servant, you knew, it implies, you knew, did you, that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed? I'm some sort of crook, am I? Is that what you think I am? Therefore, you ought, at the very least, to have deposited my money with the bankers, and at my coming, I would have received back my own with interest. At least I got something back, if you've been at least, you know, just a tad energetic, done something, but you've done nothing. Nothing at all. You've been bone idle. You've been lazy. You've not put any effort at all into the work I gave you to do. And of course, a separation has come here, hasn't it? This guy was not prepared, not working at the things you've been working at, not ready for a harvest, no fruit. And it says, verse 28, therefore take the talent from him and give it to him who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more will be given, and he will have abundance. But from him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the unprofitable servant into the outer darkness. There will be weeping and the gnashing of teeth. So, a separation. And obviously, some were industrious and busy and going about, if you like, their calling actively, always prepared, always ready. One wasn't. And so, separation. And I think it's still basically implying, you know, be ready, be alert, and be active, be industrious. Otherwise, you've got serious problems. Before we turn to the next one, let's go back to Revelation chapter 3. I think we can see the echo of this end time in Revelation chapter 3, verses 14 to the end. Because Revelation chapter 3, verse 14 talks about the final era. At least most of us believe it to be the final era of God's church. And it says, to the angel of the church of the Laodiceans write, these things says the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. I know your works, and you are neither cold nor hot. I could wish you were cold or hot. So then because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew you out of my mouth. You know, here are a people, and they are not industrious. They are not active. They are not preparing. They are not prepared. They are not ready. They think they are, of course. Don't they? Like the five foolish virgins, perhaps. They think they're okay. When it comes time to get some light out of them, there's nothing there. Verse 17, because you say, this is what they say, I'm rich, have become wealthy, have need of nothing, and you do not know. You don't understand that you are, in my eyes, wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire that you may be rich, and white garments that you may be clothed, that the shame, the disgusting shame of your nakedness may not be revealed. And please, anoint your eyes with eye salve that you may see. You know, these people thought they were pretty good. They thought they were ready, but of course they weren't. You know, their heart wasn't in it. They were people that hear the sayings of God, of Jesus, but don't do them. They're fools. As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten, ever be zealous and repent. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and dine with him and he with me. But you know, let's face it, there comes a time when the knocking is over. There's a time to hear the knock. There's a time to open up. And if you leave it too long, you'll be shut out. To him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. He was an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches, plural. Okay, back to Matthew 25. And verse 31. So, this is another parable of sorts. And again, the different angles you could look at, different meanings, I guess, that Jesus has woven into it. But I'm basically continuing the same theme of people who are ready, prepared, working for God, and a separation, which we've seen already, all the way down through chapter 24. And it really continues here. We see a separation, which starts now, but continues as it happens all the way through the millennium. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. So a separation. This particular separation will continue, you know, for 1,000 years. But the whole theme of Jesus' discussion at the moment is be ready, be prepared, be doing what's right, because a separation is coming. Verse 33, he will set the sheep on his right hand and the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on his right hand, come you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you a drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? Well, don't remember doing any of that for you, Jesus. And the king will answer and say to them, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. So part of the separation is based upon, you know, people being ready, people giving, people showing love, people, you know, acting like Jesus did. And the king, okay, then down to verse 41. Then he will say also to those on the left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. It's not everlasting for people. It's prepared for the devil and his angels. For For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, you did not take me in. Naked, you did not clothe me. Sick, and in prison, and you did not visit me. And then they will also answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry, or thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister to you? Then he will answer them, saying, Assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into everlasting punishment, punishment, not punishing, but the righteous into eternal life. A separation which starts with Christ's return and the disciples and continues on for 1,000 years thereafter. Okay, chapter 26. And I think we're now getting right into the time of Jesus' arrest and crucifixion and so on. Chapter 26, verse 1. Now it came to pass, when Jesus had finished all these sayings, that he said to his disciples, You know that after 2 days is the Passover, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified. So he's been increasingly plain and blunt with them about what's about to happen. Unfortunately, they seem to be increasingly blunt of hearing and don't seem to be picking up at all on what's just round the corner. Then the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders of the people assembled at the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, and plotted to take Jesus by trickery and kill him. But they said, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar among the people. So it's quite, I guess, quite distressing to think that these are religious leaders. This is the chief priests. These are the scribes. That's the experts and the law of God. These are the elders of the people. And what are they doing? You know, Jesus has been teaching the truth. He's been healing the blind, the lepers, the lame, the maimed. He's been moved with compassion. And look what these religious leaders are up to. They want to kill the Messiah. Kill the anointed one, you know, jealousy, envy, whatever, but to do it by trickery, it says, by stealth, by deception, so the people don't find out for a while. So really quite nasty, very vindictive, and you know, people have said probably quite truly that there's nothing quite as mean as religious people, because really God's way of life is not religion per se, it's a way of life. A religion is what the Muslims and the Catholics and perhaps others, Baptists and so on, have a religion. But you and I are called just to live a life which is according to God's law, so that, you know, Jesus should live his life in us in spirit. It's a way of life, not just a religion. But these are religious people, and there's nothing meaner than religious people if you get contrary to their beliefs. Verse 6. When Jesus was in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper, a woman came to him having an alabaster flask of very costly fragrant oil, and she poured it on his head as he sat at the table. This turns out to be Mary. I think the Gospel of John refers to her as Mary, the sister of Martha. Remember Mary and Martha? And Martha had been very busy looking after the house and preparing meals, while Mary sat at Jesus' feet and had chosen the better part so she could be educated in the ways of God. And Martha got quite hot under the collar at some point about that. And of course Lazarus, who was raised from the dead, was their brother. And this is Mary, sister of Martha and Lazarus, and she brings this very, very expensive oil and pours it over Jesus and his head, and I think it cascades down to his feet. But when the disciples saw it, they were indignant, saying, to what purpose is this waste? For this fragrant oil might have been sold for much and given to the poor. But when Jesus was aware of it, he said to them, why do you trouble the woman? You know, she was probably quite upset in many ways, because, you know, she'd done a pretty good deed here. Jesus was most impressed with it. But his disciples, you know, like men sometimes, just oblivious to what's going on around them. It says, for she's done a good work for me. For you have the poor with you always, but me you do not have always. I mean, the poor will be there tomorrow and next month and next year and the year after and the year after. But of course, Jesus was, his time was running down. Only a few weeks later, he'd be ascending to heaven, so they could take all the time they want to assist the poor, but for Jesus, you know, the clock was ticking. Verse 12, for in pouring this fragrant oil on my body, she did it for my burial. And I guess what Jesus is implying is that Mary was sharp enough, female intuition to know that Jesus meant what he said. He said, I'm going to be delivered up to be crucified, and she must have believed it, saw it, and decided to pour this fragrant oil on Jesus, if you like, in type, as a burial substance. But of course, the disciples are busy still arguing about who's going to be great in the kingdom, and I'm higher than you are, and all the rest of it. So they were just thick at times, quite dull, and Mary, like many women, was a lot more sharp here, and saw the truth more plainly. I guess her female intuition helped her there, certainly more than the boys in this particular instance. Verse 13, assuredly I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be told as a memorial to her. So Jesus was impressed, gratified, delighted, touched. The disciples were grieving over how much money we could have got for this and given it to the poor, because we're wonderful people, aren't we? And of course, it turns out, I think it probably mentioned in John as well, that it was Judas Iscariot, keeper of the purse, who was the one that was the ringleader in talking about, selling this for the poor and so on, because he would probably take a portion of that himself. But clearly the other disciples endorsed, Judas's, perverse view. Verse 14, then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, what are you willing to give me if I deliver him to you? Even though I'm a disciple, I can pass him over. And they counted out to him 30 pieces of silver, which was prophesied way back in Zechariah. So from that time, he, Judas, sought opportunity to betray him. Not nice, is it, really? 12 disciples that you've taught, helped, supported, shared meals with, and here's one of your companions busy off doing a deal with a bunch of religious, mean-minded crooks, and just looking for a quiet time to get Jesus taken away. Now, on the first day of, this is a terrible translation, now on the first day of the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, the disciples came to Jesus saying to him, where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover? Well, so it wasn't the Feast of Unleavened Bread, because it hadn't started yet. Indeed, that's in italics in hopefully most translations. This is talking on the first day of the Unleavened Bread, and this was the preparation day for the Passover. We've covered that, I think, at Passover time, so I won't do that again. But where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover? And Jesus said, go into the city to a certain man and say to him, the teacher says, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples. So the disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover. Jesus was keeping the Passover. He did keep the Passover. Some say he didn't, that he was hanging on the stake on the cross, and therefore he didn't get to keep it. Well, he did keep it. It says quite bluntly that he kept the Passover. He kept it at the right time. Most of the Galileans kept it along with Jesus at the beginning of the 14th. There were others, particularly in Judea, that kept it at the end of the 14th day, which was wrong timing. So the disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover already. Verse 20, now when the evening had come, that's the end of the two evenings, end of twilight, he sat down with the 12. Now as they were eating, he said, assuredly I say to you, one of you will betray me. And they were exceedingly sorrowful, and each one of them began to say to him, Lord, is it I? And I guess they went, around the table. And Jansen said, he who dipped his hand with me in the dish will betray me. The Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been good for that man if he had not been born. Then Judas, who was betraying him, answered, said, Rabbi, is it I? He said to him, you have said it. And interesting or peculiar that the other said, Lord, is it I? And Judas said, Rabbi, is it I? Perhaps he didn't quite be able to say, Lord or Master, is it I? Because clearly already he was going to give over Jesus to the the leaders, so he says, simply says, "Teacher, teacher, teacher, is it I?" They said, "Lord, Lord, is it I? Is it I? Is it I?" "No, no, it's not you, not you, not you." "Rabbi, teacher, is it I?" "Yeah, yeah, you said it." Verse 26. "And as they were eating, Jesus took bread, blessed it, broke it, and gave it to the disciples and said, 'Take, eat. This is, or represents, my body.'" This bread that I've broken represents my body. "Then he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, 'Drink from it, all of you, for this is, or represents, my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins.'" So there was the bread, and there was the wine, there was the body and the blood. We've covered that in some detail. We all, or many people, know what the blood represents, and Jesus' death and so on, but not as many have any clear understanding of the bread and Jesus' broken body, and why Jesus' body was scourged and whipped and broken so badly, and not the bones, but the flesh and arteries and you name it, torn and shredded. That was for a reason. That was because, you know, Jesus was purchasing our healing by giving his body over to be beaten and, you know, take the pain and suffering upon him. Verse 29, "But I say to you, I'll not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom." And when they sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Then Jesus said to them, "All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night." Because Jesus knew what was about to happen. He knew the scriptures extremely well, and the rest didn't. "For it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered." Once the leader's gone, the rest will just flee. "But after I've been raised, I will go before you to Galilee." So, you know, again, a plain comment there. I will be raised. I'm going to be, you know, handed over. I'm going to be crucified. I'm going to die. But I'm going to be resurrected. He said that several times, but they plainly didn't get it. "After I've been raised, I will go before you to Galilee." And they missed it again. Peter answered and said to him, "Even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble, because I'm Peter." You know, they might be wimps and run off, but not me. You know, I'm your man, Jesus, right behind you, side by side, all the way. And Jesus said to him, "Assuredly, I say to you, Peter, that this night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me not once, not twice, but three times." Peter said to him, "Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And so said all the disciples, all to a man, right behind you, Jesus. You can rest assured. We've been with you for years now. We won't desert you. You know, we're your men, right behind you, all the way to the kingdom. And of course, within a matter of 10 minutes, they were all gone. But I guess that's a good place to conclude for tonight. And so we'll, I think, finish there for today. And I guess we might even manage to finish, possibly, the book of Matthew next week. We will see. But for now, let's conclude the Bible study.